From Washington, the nation's capital, the Voice of America presents Issues in the News. The nation's top Washington correspondents offer their perspectives on the week's major stories. Your moderator is Fred Barnes of the Weekly Standard. Issues in the News begins now.
Welcome to Issues in the News. I'm Fred Barnes of the Weekly Standard. Joining me today on the show are Abdirahim Fukara, Washington Bureau Chief of Al Jazeera Satellite TV, and Tim Mack, Senior Congressional Correspondent for the Daily Beast. And here are the issues. Protesters in Hong Kong were attacked by pro-China residents as the standoff with the Beijing-aligned government in Hong Kong over democratic rights continued. In Dallas, a Liberian man was diagnosed with the Ebola virus as fears of a spread of that disease increased in the United States. And in Turkey, the parliament voted to authorize military intervention in Syria and Iraq. Well, Tim, I know your parents came from Hong Kong. What do you make of this pro-democracy demonstrations there? It's really over whether Beijing is going to decide who's the candidates can be in the so-called election, which I guess will be, what, in 2017?
That's right.
And it sparked, led by students, massive protests. And the question that comes to mind, and I'll ask it right at the first, can this be another Tiananmen?
Well, that's the real fear from protesters on the street. And so far, we haven't seen any activity from Chinese troops, that China is willing to bring this up to the next level. So far, we've seen things that are actually relatively tame when it comes to major protests in urban areas. Yes, we've seen tear gas. And yes, we've seen some examples of police pushing back forcefully against protesters. But we haven't seen anything that rises to the level that suggests that we're going to see really widespread violence in the streets where protesters are shot dead. I think the Chinese really don't want to see that in Hong Kong, which has been such a driver of economic growth for the Chinese state. Now, on the other hand, Hong Kong will never be the same again. I mean, after these protests, it will be clear that people out there will not tolerate the kind of restrictions on freedom that people in the Chinese mainland feel. That people in Hong Kong, after having been a British protectorate for so long, will not tolerate aggression back to a place where they can't speak freely, protest freely, or be ruled by people who they have no consideration of.
The thing that sparked this was the effort by Beijing to say they would have to screen, in other words, the Chinese Communist government would have to screen any candidates to run in 2017 in the election to decide who would be the leaders in Hong Kong.
Right.
Was that a violation of the agreement that initially the British and the U.S. signed on to this in a way, but the British turned Hong Kong over to the Chinese government?
It is a violation in the sense that the basic law, the constitutional document, which was agreed upon when the British handed over Hong Kong to the Chinese, outlines a fully free and fair election for the chief executive of the Hong Kong government by 2017. Now, the Chinese government has tried to get around this by saying everyone can vote, there will be universal suffrage, but we get to choose the candidates. They're not sufficiently patriotic to the Chinese state. They can't run. And that's unacceptable to the protesters, and that's why we see tens of thousands of students and other protesters out in the streets.
Abdi, what's your take on this? It's quite a story.
It is. You mentioned Tiananmen Square. I mean, in addition, in terms of differences, in addition to what Tim has just said about this situation where Hong Kong is anchored in a sort of British democratic tradition, which doesn't exist in the rest of China, the other difference is that Tiananmen Square happened in the heart of China, the heart of the base of Chinese power. This is Hong Kong, which is, while being economically an engine of economic growth in China, politically it is sort of on the periphery, away from Beijing. The question to me remains, first of all, what happens in Hong Kong itself, what the final outcome is going to be, and whether, if this drags on, whether there is even a slight chance that it might spill into mainland China. All the indications so far are that mainland China could be immunized from what's going on in Hong Kong. I think both the protesters and the government are reading from the page books of the so-called Arab Spring. We have seen this talk about what happened in the Arab world in 2011 when talking about Hong Kong. But on the side of the government, we are also seeing them reading from the same book, which is, you basically unleash your supporters. Many of them in the Arab world are called Baltajiya or thugs. Mm-hmm. We're beginning to see that happening. The concern, obviously, in Hong Kong is that this is student-led. And the feeling is that when these things are student-led, they don't last very long. Mm-hmm. And they lead to splits in the leadership of the protests, which would make it very easy or easier for the Chinese government to deal with it.
That's why I was a little surprised when they unleashed some of these, what you would call thugs, and I would too, since it had looked like the Chinese policy was what you were saying, let the protests sort of expire, let the energy slowly dissipate and hope it would go away. One more question. I'm reading from a piece in the New York Post by Seth Lipsky, who was a reporter in Hong Kong a number of years ago, and he says, if freedom comes to China, it is going to enter through Hong Kong. Well, I don't know that that's true. What do you think of that idea?
Well, I think that you will have to go back in history. We talked about the document whereby Hong Kong reverted back to China. I am sure that at that time, the Chinese authorities had their eyes on the future in terms of the stuff that's happening now unfolding in Hong Kong. And in addition to immunizing mainland China, they obviously want to maintain Hong Kong as the engine of economic growth. Talking of economic growth, the real immunization as they see it in China against the kind of things that we're seeing in Hong Kong now is raising per capita income of people in China. And, you know, there has been real progress in those terms inside the China. The average Chinese is much wealthier today than he or she was 10 years ago, certainly than they were when Hong Kong reverted back to China. A question, and we've seen this in the Middle East, the question is, how long can you use economic growth to trump up democracy and liberties? But it also depends on what the US and the other Western democracies do to help people in Hong Kong go in the particular direction that they want to go. We have seen so far the West being very skittish about antagonizing the Chinese authorities.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I'll get to that in a minute. The sentence after the one I read from Seth Lipsky is this: the city, meaning Hong Kong, already had its taste of liberty, if only a taste, and it just is never going to forget.
It certainly will never forget. I mean, and that's why you have people protesting now. Because they've advanced to a point that they don't want to regress. But I do think I have to take issue with what Lipsky's saying here. Mm-hmm. I don't think that if liberty is going to come to China, it's going to come through Hong Kong. And that's for a number of reasons. Firstly, because people in Hong Kong speak a different dialect of Chinese than do the rest of China. They speak Cantonese, whereas most people in China speak Mandarin. Cantonese is a kind of marginal language that's spoken mostly just on the frontier of China. And that's one reason. And secondly, what these protests have really shown is that there is a serious clash and difference between Hong Kong, people who live in Hong Kong, and mainlanders. It's really exposed this rift and longstanding tension between people in China who many people in Hong Kong feel are benefiting from Hong Kong's economic engine without really contributing back a lot. We don't see that there's a lot of unity between people in Hong Kong or protesters in Hong Kong and maybe activists in the mainland. Mm-hmm. That's because of, say, language barriers or because there isn't very good communication. It doesn't strike me that a democratic movement in China is going to take hold because of protests in Hong Kong. There's a lot of antagonism there, and I think that's what Lipsky's missing.
Mm-hmm. Well, what do you make of, Abdi raised the question of mainland China's doing much better economically. Mm-hmm. People are doing much better. They may not be as susceptible to a democratic message coming from Hong Kong as they might have been some years ago.
Sure. I think the Chinese authorities have been keeping an eye on this precise question as kind of a central driver of their thinking for a very long time, because economic growth at the pace that it's been going can only go on for so long. And once that's finished, people are going to start thinking about political rights, about their civil liberties. Mm-hmm. And once that happens, there is going to be a deep tension.
Mm-hmm. You know, one of the theories, Abdi, I know you've heard this, and that is that once people get economic rights and do well, then they will demand democratic political rights. That does not seem to have happened in mainland China, however.
It does not. I think, as Tim said, that's clearly, you know, all the historical evidence is there. Mm-hmm. But that's a temporary fix. At some point, even if you're bribing, if a government is bribing the population mm-hmm. with money and benefits, and again, we have seen this in various parts of the rich Middle East mm-hmm. where oil reigns supreme. At some point, the argument that, okay, I'm going to give you all the material benefits you need, but you will shut up when it comes to your liberties, mm-hmm. at some point that begins to run out of steam.
Well, let me ask you about a question, an issue you raised, and that is Europe, the West, the United States, and so on, has stayed out of this. I'm trying to think of whether the Obama White House has issued any statement at all on what's going on in Hong Kong, and none comes to mind anyway. The United States has been the champion of democracy around the world, and isn't it incumbent upon the administration in Washington to say something? It doesn't have to be strong support of the protesters, but something to at least support democratic rights in Hong Kong.
I mean, to be fair, we have heard some statements from, you know, various corners of the administration mm-hmm. about what's going on in Hong Kong. But they have been at best faint and circumspect. Mm-hmm. Specifically in the case of the Obama administration as the leader of a Western mm-hmm. democracy, certainly the administration has other fish to fry at the moment. Mm-hmm. There's the issue of ISIS or ISIL, as President Obama calls it, mm-hmm. in terms of trying to push for helping various peoples around the world determine their own fate. That also has been a major headache for the Obama administration in the case of Ukraine, for example. Mm-hmm. So the U.S. At this particular point in time, particularly given the fact that China and Russia are potential allies in lots of spheres, I think that may to explain to a certain extent why the Obama administration has been so faint and circumspect in terms of supporting the protesters. But having said that, I think they may also be saying, let's bide our time and for a while and see first how tenuous the protests are going to be. Because if the Obama administration comes out in full swing supporting mm-hmm. the protests and then they fizzle out for some reason, then its position is going to look a little difficult, especially given the huge economic stakes in relations between China and the United States.
Tim, what about this point of not just the United States, but Europe and others taking a position on the democratic protests?
Yeah, I mean, so far we've seen very weak statements from the Obama administration, basically just urging restraint from the Chinese authorities and saying very broadly that they believe in the right to protest without any actual support for the protesters or their demands. Mm-hmm. The question is what the United States could actually do in some meaningful way to support the protesters, and there really isn't that much. I mean, we've heard here in D.C. some mentions of congressional action mm-hmm. or a congressional resolution expressing support, but mm-hmm. really it's up to the protesters to get what they want. Mm-hmm. And actually, outside expressions of support could hurt more than help mm-hmm. in the sense that the Chinese authorities are already accusing the protesters of being led by foreign forces, being influenced yeah. by outsiders. And the United States' involvement in this could be a very small moral victory mm-hmm. and a much deeper defeat in terms of the optics on the ground.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I can't think of anything in particular that's tangible that the U.S. government could do. But I remember in the Iranian Green Revolution, the protesters there were calling Yes. on President Obama to say something and support them, and he was very hesitant to do it, and finally had a weak statement, but it was after a number of days. I've read a lot about the pro-democracy protests in Hong Kong. I haven't heard of their calling for U.S. vocal support.
You know, the funny thing is that so much has changed even since the Green Revolution in Iran that they no longer need an expression of state support. You know, they've got these very innovative ways for people all over the world to show their support for protesters in China. Mm. One example of technological advance is that they've set up these projectors at protest sites all over Hong Kong. You go online if you're a supporter of the protesters and you can send a message of support. Mm. And you've got people all over the world
writing, and it appears on screen.
And it appears on the projector in Hong Kong on official state buildings, on the side of official state buildings. Yeah. And that's a very powerful message that can be sent from people in Ukraine, from Europe, from the United States, or in Singapore, or wherever else, who are saying, hey, we support these protests. Mm-hmm. And in a way, that's almost as much of a moral victory as any sort of official state statement would be.
Would you like to add anything?
Yeah, I just wanted to add, you know, the self-motivation factor in Hong Kong. I mean, one of the fundamental differences between what's happening in Hong Kong, what happened in Ukraine, what happened in the Middle East 3 years ago, is that because of their British connection historically, people in Hong Kong have this historical tradition. And I'm not comparing by any means Hong Kong to Britain, but it would be almost as if the Scottish, before the referendum a couple of weeks ago, called for US help. They didn't. And I think we have a similar logic here. They feel that they have enough democratic credentials to be self-propelled themselves. Having said that, if at some point they feel that they're really running aground with the protests, that could change in terms of calling for help and succor from the outside. Moral, that is.
All right, we'll have more in just a minute. This is a reminder that you're listening to Issues on the News coming to you on the Voice of America in Washington. I'm your moderator, Fred Barnes of the Weekly Standard. Joining me on the show today are Tim Mack of the Daily Beast and Abdurrahim Fukara of Al Jazeera. And this is a reminder that you can listen to Issues online as a podcast. Please visit our website at voanews.com. Well, let's talk about the Ebola issue, but particularly, Abdi, in the United States. Unlike Britain and France, the United States has not barred flights from West Africa. They let this Liberian man came in. I think he lied about whether he had who he had seen and what he had been doing in Liberia. It turns out he has the Ebola virus. About 100 people he may or may not have come in contact with are being observed by medical officials in Dallas, Texas. And here's my question. My own view is that the U.S. is not in a state of panic over this, but people, a little more, a few other examples of the Ebola virus breaking out, and it could produce real concern. And I wonder why the government, the medical officials in the United States nationally, haven't taken a harder stand against the Ebola virus and anybody who might have it.
Well, I mean, traditionally, Fred, you're American and you know this much better than I do. Traditionally, the ocean played in favor of this country. It just feels protected, or it had felt in the past protected from so many different world problems because of the distance from the rest of the world, particularly in the case of Ebola from Africa. I think the first problem that rises now is with the airline companies, because the onus will be on airline companies to do something about that. But we've heard reassurance over the weeks, even before this case in Texas, here in the U.S., that this is not such a dangerous situation after all, that the U.S. is equipped in terms of scientific research to deal with. In terms of its hospitals now, the assurance we're hearing is that its hospitals in terms of being able to quarantine people are there. And then, quite frankly, there's another factor, which is that we are talking about, in the specific case in Texas, we're talking about a Liberian connection. I think people have to be reminded that perhaps of all African states, Liberia has a special ring here in the United States, particularly in the ear of African Americans. This was a country originally set up to free slaves from taken back to Africa from America. And therefore, to come out and make such a big fuss about it. We've heard the Liberian president over the last couple of days talking to Canadian media, and she's very concerned about what this may mean for U.S.-Liberian relations. Even if you put aside the domestic panic that this may cause here in the United States, there are international ramifications for the U.S. And I think from what I've seen, I have seen some what I would call political wisdom in dealing so far with the issue of Ebola. If it blows up big time and we're just a few weeks away from the midterm congressional elections, then there would be serious political fallout from any Ebola cases here in the U.S.
Tim?
Well, that's really interesting. I hadn't thought very much about the political ramifications of Ebola. And I think right now we have a situation where there's a lot more hype than there is danger, right? And it's an unexpected case. here on U.S. soil, and it's kind of discussion piece of a lot of people over happy hours and at dinner and you know, in the workplace.
At my house, for one,
definitely, and it's what's on people's minds. But we're certainly spending more mental energy on it than it probably deserves at the moment. It hasn't mutated into something more dangerous. And, you know, there's an abundance of caution right now being displayed by American authorities. It should probably be controlled. The question, and if we're going to look at this from a political perspective, is that already there are some lawmakers kind of trying to get the Obama administration to explain why they haven't taken more dramatic steps to limit flights from West Africa to the United States. You have Senator Ted Cruz, for example, asking why the FAA stopped flights to Israel during their war with Gaza and is not yet stopping flights from West Africa. I mean, well, that's clearly a political play.
Yeah, those are completely different situations.
Totally different situations, but you have conservative red meat already set up there. So, I mean, yeah, there are going to be political, as with almost anything of a certain prominence, there is going to be a political angle to it, and here you have it.
I guess I'm just always suspicious when you hear, oh, don't worry about that, when you hear that from a national administration.
Especially when you hear it from people who are dressed in full body suits.
Well, I'm laughing. I shouldn't be, because it's so serious, and many people have died, and more will. Anyway, let me turn to Turkey. Turkey, President Erdogan, has decided to authorize the Turkish military to intervene in Syria and Iraq. Why now, Abdi?
I think, first of all, I'm not sure what the extent of that authorization is, actually. Whether that authorization is going to be interpreted by Erdogan or others in his circle as saying, okay, we've wanted to do this for a long time, get into Syria, help change the regime, not just ISIS, or whether it will be interpreted as saying we will mobilize and will not go into land action unless our territory is actually threatened and attacked by ISIS. I think that's, as far as I can see, that's where things stand for the Turks. The Turks have been under tremendous pressure regionally, but also internationally, to actually take a tougher stance on ISIS. There have been accusations, as you know, to the Turks that they've allowed the influx of fighters through their borders into Syria, for example, to fight on the side of ISIS for months now. So in terms of relations with the outside world, it is in their benefit, this authorization that has come through. It is in their benefit to be seen as actually giving Erdogan the right to do what a lot of people want the Turks to do. Question remains is, if the United States is saying no ground troops will be committed to this effort against ISIS, the French are saying no ground troops, all the major powers are saying no ground troops, and our allies in the Middle East are not required to commit ground troops, a lot of Turks will be saying, well, why should we commit ground troops in this case? We'll protect our border. We do what we have to do to protect our own citizens. And if the situation develops in a way that necessitates sending troops into Syria or Iraq, then at that particular point, we'll do it. There remains the other wrinkle, which is the Turks saying no to the U.S. using their military base in Turkey. And we've gone through that before in 2003 when George Bush wanted to invade Iraq and he asked for their authorization to use Incirlik base and they said no.
And also to do more, to actually send
ground troops through
Turkey.
And they said no. But I think, just as a final thought, now they are sandwiched, the Turks are sandwiched between committing to the fight against ISIS, which will, by the way, necessitate, by definition, the help of NATO, without sending the wrong message to the Russians. The Turks are very worried about the Russians, that the West is about to use Turkey to get to Russia over the issue of Ukraine and Crimea. They're playing a very complex game, the Turks.
And, of course, Russia, Tim, is supporting the regime in Syria. What's your take on what Turkey might be up to or should be up to? My own view is, as a member of NATO, at some point, if ISIS continues to be such a huge threat as it is now, they will probably have to allow flights out of the American Air Force base in Turkey. If they were not a member of NATO, it would be easier to continue saying no, but they may have to do that.
You know, one of the most interesting stories that I've been thinking about with regards to this with this conflict is the entangling alliances and the various, very strange interests that different groups have in this whole conflict. That it's not very clear, for example, who the moderate opposition in Syria is, or their relationships with ISIS, whether they're fighting ISIS or if they're fighting Bashar al-Assad's regime. Mm. If we equip moderate opposition, whether they might share these weapons with ISIS to fight Assad or with Assad to fight ISIS. It's very confusing what the American role would be. I mean, that's a real problem for policymakers here in D.C. is that it's very unclear what the long-term ramifications of training these rebels would be and whether the American answer to the problem is nearly sufficient to the task at hand. Whether training 5,000 moderate Syrian rebels to take on an estimated 30,000 ISIS forces is going to be an adequate response to the issue.
That's certainly true. It's a very touchy role for President Obama in the United States. And I mentioned quickly here at the end, Abdi, that I believe the Turks will probably at some point allow the American airbase to be used. What's your thought about that?
Well, I think the Turks would have to, just circling back to what I said earlier about mm-hmm. NATO, I think the Turks would have to get some serious assurances and guarantees, particularly from the United States, mm-hmm. that if NATO has to be called upon to help the Turks deal with the issue of ISIS, that the United States and the rest of the NATO alliance would stand with them should that rattle the Russians. Because I think mm-hmm. that the main mm-hmm. problem they have now mm-hmm. is the Russians. If they are pushed to attack ISIS, particularly if ISIS attack Turkish territory, mm-hmm. they would do it and they would allow the United States to use the airbase in Turkey. At what point will that happen? I mean, Tim has been talking about the imponderables. There are still a lot of questions that mm-hmm. we don't know mm-hmm. about not only how this operation is unfolding, but what's actually driving it.
Mm-hmm. Well, thank you both. That's all the time we have. Joining us today were Abdirahim Fukara, Washington Bureau Chief of Al Jazeera Satellite TV, and Tim Mack, Senior Congressional Correspondent for The Daily Beast. This program was produced by Anya Zalewski. Our engineer was Justin Thwaites. I'm Fred Barnes of The Weekly Standard. Thank you for listening.
From Washington, the nation's capital, the Voice of America has brought you Issues in the News. You can email your questions or comments to our panelists. Send them to voanews@voanews.com. And to keep up with all the latest news, tune in the Voice of America on radio, television, or the World Wide Web. Join us next week at this time for Issues in the News.